Okay, I have your legal consent.
Roll the timpani. Ladies and gentlemen. The Muppet Show. I don't know. It's like all these shows in one show where basically everything to everybody. Am I ruining it so far?
No, not at all.
There is nothing to ruin.
Oh, great.
It can only go
thank
up.
God.
There is a distinct lack of formality in this podcast. We mostly just ramble until we somehow stumble into a movie. But we're glad to have you here. I you know, we can introduce you. I think literally anyone listening to this podcast will know who you are because, you know, the circle of the internet and what have you. But thank you for joining us, Adam.
Thank you for inviting me. No, thank you for allowing me to invite myself.
Well, of course. I mean, it is a bit strange that this is the first time that we've had a guest, or I guess even you and me, Joe, where we've talked about a movie that somebody that like we've worked on. Like you actually worked on Torque, and we're going to talk about it. That's new ground for our show.
Right. Well, I caught the screen cap of your conversation with each other on Twitter. Was it 2 nights ago?
The one where I tricked Joe into admitting that he would let me use this movie for the podcast because he was very upset with me when I made him watch Detention. What was it, last year sometime?
Oh, it's terrible.
Did you actually go see it since last time I talked to you?
Did I? No, I think I watched maybe the first 10 minutes of it or something on accident.
I'm pretty sure when I was out there working with you that I tried to convince you to watch it, and I probably spent a long, long time talking about how great it was because it was a very weird movie and I enjoyed it, but it's not for everyone.
No. Dan bought it for me to make me watch it for the podcast because it wasn't available for streaming or anything, and so he was just like, now I have it looking
Nor
at me every
be.
Time I open up iTunes. I have the poster for Detention staring at me.
You have the life-sized cutouts of the stars of the movie literally next to your bed because Dan bought them for you.
You know, I tried to get the AMC in San Francisco to give me the poster for Detention when it was about to be released and no longer in theaters, and they told me to come back the next day because it would probably be in the trash or something, and I didn't have time to come back to San Francisco for it.
Well, they were probably pretty rare because they only printed like 8 of them.
Yeah, it did not have a huge theatrical showing, but that was probably because there wasn't much or any marketing for it. But
one, or not much writing either. One of the first, if I remember, one of the first jokes in the movie was something about, haha, like that movie Torque. Like it was an in-joke about the movie Torque, which is, you know, your audience is pretty limited for that one.
Yeah, he says it makes about as much sense as that stupid movie Torque. Because,
right.
You know, as I'm sure we'll discuss here on this podcast about Torque, not Detention, this movie had some troubles getting made, did it not?
I don't know about getting made. I think it got greenlit pretty easily, probably, because it was in an era when they were handing out movies to music video and commercial directors, especially music video directors, because they would dazzle with their fancy footwork on the, you know, on the screen, and they were not mistaken. I think that, and you know, not to go on a rant here. That was my Dennis Miller. Not to go off on a rant. I'm not going to go on a rant. This is going to be a dialogue about this movie. But as I understand it, the studio was eager to make their own version of Fast and Furious for motorcycles. And I don't think that they really spent too much time perfecting the script, but they were really excited about having Joseph Kahn on board because he really is a visionary. There's no way around that. He's a visionary director.
Yeah, it seems that I mean, again, I'm a fan of him as a director in general. A lot of his commercial music video work, I think he's incredibly talented at what he does. I don't think it entirely shows in this movie or necessarily Detention, unfortunately. But you can see, and you know, he's mentioned this in places where he was battling script rewrites and people from the studio on set sort of going, what are you doing? Why are you putting the camera there? That's kind of strange. People don't normally do that kind of thing.
And totally. Yeah. They were always up in his grill, and everybody was sort of, I think that there was a lot of tittering about some of the decisions, some of the suspect calls that he was making. For instance, there's that one There's this one shot of Adam Scott starting the engine in his Hummer, and Adam Scott playing the corrupt cop, the dirty cop. And Adam Scott, like, the camera is basically a fisheye lens from the POV of the keyhole in this, you know, the ignition in this Hummer. And so you see Adam Scott putting this comically large key up to the camera. And it's a very quick shot, but I just remember the visual effects supervisor sort of like leaning over to me and, or the visual effects producer rather, leaning over to me and telling me that everybody was up in arms because that key, that prop, large key, cost something like $5,000 just to pull off the world's stupidest visual gag.
Oh. I mean, it's an interesting quick little montage. There's a lot of them in this where he does sort of that the thing that Edgar Wright has been praised for, the like the quick close-up montage of shots that transition from one scene to another. Mm-hmm. Do you remember how early on in production the key was? Was that like the beginning of the end, or was that when he was in the middle of it and just sort of said, screw it, let's go with it?
I feel like it was about halfway through. For me, I came on production. They had already been shooting for a couple of weeks, and there were 3 months of production. So I was on for the rest of it. And at some point it started all in downtown LA. It was literally my first job in the industry after moving out here. It was super exciting. It was in downtown. And then, near Boyle Heights, there were actually on the edge of the arts district in downtown. And then we picked up and went to the desert for 2 weeks, I think, and shot all that train stuff. And then came back and shot a big old huge sequence in downtown, you know, in the proper crowded metropolitan area. And, almost got killed on that. I don't know.
Almost got killed. How?
An explosion, like a proper pyro. You guys saw, Tropic Thunder. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, the Danny McBride character.
Yes.
Yeah.
In that he just loves to blow shit up. And so there was a lot of pyro on that movie on Torque. And there's a scene where, Ford, the hero character, Martin Henderson, I think.
Yeah.
He gets blown off of his Y2K motorcycle and like flies off into flies out of the alley and lands on the street. I think it's the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there's a big pyro gag, and the way they do those is they'll like fill a drum, like an oil drum, with tons of explosives and then ignite it somehow. And it goes boom, and they shoot it with five cameras or whatever. And, it's very exciting, and everybody covers their ears and hope nothing goes wrong. There was a bunch of crews like standing on the opposite side of the street. So there's an alley and it's perpendicular to a street with buildings. And so we were sort of under an awning there, and then they ignite the pyro and they do the stunt. And then unforeseen, the force of the explosion is so great that it blows out all the windows of the building above where me and all the crew were standing.
Oh dear.
So the glass rains down like just inches from where we are. That was kind of a fun, exciting time.
So that like three story high pyro gag blew the windows off the side of a nice downtown, what, bank or something, and just rained glass on everyone. That's
exactly. But you know, it was worth it because the history of cinema will show.
Sure, I mean it's one of the most memorable explosions in cinema. When you ask people, you know, what's your favorite explosion in a movie, it's that one where the motorcycle that has a helicopter engine explodes and throws the guy out of the alley.
Right, exactly. There's basically two moments in cinema. There's Rosebud and
I mean, you know. The Y2K is a little bit faster than a sled down a hill, so.
You spoiled Citizen Kane for everyone, Dan.
Oh, yeah, the part where he jumps on Rosebud and starts sledding down the hill?
Exactly. And then, Kane hops up on top of a train. There's that part of the film.
He jumps off the sled just in time for the sled to fly into the fire. That's
Because he's got to get to Xanadu, which is covered, surrounded by roadblocks.
You know, I wouldn't be entirely surprised if somebody tried to do something that ridiculous. You know, this is... I think it's kind of weird. Have you guys seen any of the Fast and Furious movies since the beginning? Or I guess any at all is, I guess, a reasonable question.
I will admit that I have not.
I saw the first one, but it was so long ago that I don't remember any details of it.
Right.
Well, you know, back then it was very sort of serious and street racy and stuff. And I actually just recently watched, what is it, Fast and Furious 7, the most recent one. And it, I think, is probably twice as bananas as this movie. So I really kind of wish they would have kept going with the Torque franchise, because this movie, as absurd as it is, isn't nearly as absurd as the kind of junk they're doing these days in these sort of racery movies. And everyone seems to enjoy it. Like, Fast and Furious 7 made $1 zillion or something. It's not exactly high art or anything, but I kind of feel like the nonsense that occurs in Torque is, you know, it's fun to the certain group of people who enjoy watching this movie, of which Joe doesn't appear to be one.
Nope.
But you know, apparently that, you know, that audience is growing, and it's fight scenes and crazy car stunts and nonsense. Like in Fast and Furious 7, they throw cars out of an airplane and open parachutes and then land on a road, and then they're like running on top of a bus as it slides off a cliff and dive off of the bus and then catch the edge of a car as it's sliding across the edge of the cliff. It's like, it's the most insane nonsense, and it makes the train scene in Torque look tame by comparison.
Oh, that's awesome.
I kind of want them to give Joseph Kahn another giant bananas movie like this to see what he can do these days.
I do too, and I think he's probably matured a bunch. I think we'll get some real character development. No, on second thought, I don't think that's going to happen.
I was going to say, you're a little dry for radio. You're going to have to clarify if that was sarcasm
yeah.
or not.
Yeah. Waka waka. But I,
yeah,
maybe you could actually, just... you know, I do think that Torque is a fun movie. Like, I don't hate the movie. I remember having worked on it for about a year from between production and then moving on to post, first post for the visual effects department on the movie, and then visual effects on one of the facilities that was working on the movie for a good 6 months. I had a tremendous amount of ownership over the movie, even though I was, you know, just a tiny little grain of sand working on it. You know how you get that kind of Stockholm syndrome working on something for so long.
Did you go see it in theaters and drag your friends and family and go, look, no, I promise it'll be fun.
Well, no, I went with a bunch of crew from the facility that I was working on. That's like, kind of the, I think that's one of the more fun ways of seeing a movie that you've worked on, is with the people that slaved through it with you. And, you know, it was a raucous good time. I don't think anybody else in the theater liked it.
were you fully aware when you saw it in the theater of what it was, or were you still sort of riding that Stockholm syndrome?
I was, because I had seen enough, I'd been exposed to it enough through going to early studio screenings when I was still in the studio side of it, to having worked on most of the visual effects sequences. I basically knew what I was in for. It was fun to see the totality of it, because it's just like nutballs insanity. Just thinking, like, how did this ever get, you know, literally how did this get made? But
it is rather surprising. And it, you know, even with all of the, you know, the stories about, you know, studio interference, the fact that this was made as it was made in 2004, and just as sort of, you know, blatantly disdainful as it is for some of the Fast and Furious stuff, that, you know, he was able to even do some of this. I mean, it seems like the, you know, hour 24 runtime is kind of like, the intention is to keep it fast. No, the intention is to keep it feeling fast paced, and there's really no downtime between scenes. Like, you know, there are shots where someone will like drive a car out of a scene, and then right in will come the motorcycles, and you're on to the next one. So there's
absolutely, but there's like an implied, you know, scene missing slate between each scene.
It does make you wonder if there were chunks cut out of the movie, because, you know, it is light on plots and heavy on style.
There were some chunks missing. There were definitely some scenes that got taken out.
Did that seem, you know, on par with sort of your standard editorial, seeing what works in post? Or was it really like, you shot this thing and we have no idea what to do with this, so we just have to throw it away? I'm sorry.
No, it was like, I think it was the studio feeling like, well, we made this turd, so like, let's just not be precious about any of these babies, and let's freely cast away the babies and like try to keep just the bare essentials. And you know, some of the visual effects in that movie are just abysmal. And it speaks to, the, like, you know, sort of like arms in the air, I don't know, kind of attitude of like, let's just get it out there in the world, that, you know, some of this, that there was not, I don't think there was like, they didn't want to put any more money into making the stuff better. Also keeping in mind that it was 2003 and there were limitations to how good some of these effects that came straight from the depths of Joseph Kahn's imagination could actually be.
Yeah, because there's a lot of stuff for the scale of 2003, 2004-ish, whatever, that, yeah, it was 2003, sorry, where I would not have expected anyone to have attempted to execute that, like the
right.
Driving through downtown Los Angeles, CG stuff, cars everywhere kind of stuff.
Right.
Just from knowing how, like, difficult that kind of thing is to do for, like, the New York City shots and Spider-Man and stuff, even, like, 10 years after that, like, that just seems like it was maybe a bit of an overreach.
Oh, totally. It was an overreach, and it was the visual effects facility definitely overpromising, because they loved working... they loved working with Joseph. They'd worked with him a bunch before on his music videos, and this was kind of, it was going to kind of be their break into the movie world. And so this facility, Hydraulics, that's, you know, obviously still around. They loved to go large, you know, they loved to take on these huge challenges, because they knew that there was opportunity in it for them. And so they'd push all their crew and they'd, you know, spend money making these effects happen. And, I remember, like, you know, that, the downtown stuff where he's screaming through the streets of downtown on that Y2K bike. And I just remember shooting the plates for all the textures of the buildings and doing a lot, you know, going through on a truck and doing a LiDAR scan of some of the streets and being naive enough that I didn't really know what any of this meant, but that knowing that eventually they would slap it all together in like a popsicle sticks and scotch tape version of a downtown city. This was no Spider-Man, my friends. this was basically like, I don't know. It was like, oh no, Mr. Bill kind of cityscape. And yeah, it showed. I'll be honest with you.
I mentioned to you, I went back and I found that podcast where you talked about some of the stuff in the past. But right. It sounds like, at least in spite of all of the interference from studio, Joseph was allowed to be involved in the whole process. Like, at no point did they say, like, all right, you have to step out of here because we need to make a version of this that we can sell. Like, he was around the whole time when you guys were working on it?
Totally. He was into it. And because he'd been through this process, like, it was basically, it was just... For him, it was like making a really long music video.
Right.
And when you are making a music video, you can get as fanciful as you want with all the effects and use your imagination. Because, yeah, everybody on the effects side of it, who's pulling all of it off, they're going to hate you, but they're going to do it. And so it was just like pushing every boundary in that way with aesthetics. It was essentially like doing Speed Racer without the money or the taste.
Speaking of Speed Racer...
Yeah, I worked on that. Anyway, let's move on.
Well, I love that movie, by the way.
I don't.
Fair enough.
But so you had an overall positive experience, even though it was a little Stockholm-y. And you think of the movie fondly enough that you wanted to be on a podcast about it.
Right.
So, I mean... Looking back on it, like what is, I don't know, was there a favorite moment where maybe you saw the inner workings of the movie process and it all came together for you and you've moved that through the rest of what it is you do, or you just really kind of just have a nostalgic view of this being the first one?
That's an excellent question. I have two answers for you in terms of favorite moments. One favorite moment was I guess from a visual effects standpoint, finding out just how much work it takes to make every single little element that goes into a shot. Because there's, like, if you go through the IMDb trivia for this movie, it'll say director cameo. Joseph Kahn is in one of the seats on the inside of the train when they ride their motorcycles through it. And he pops in there for a second, but then to do a couple of the other shots where the camera's like outside the window or whatever, we did a whole green screen, shoot on a stage and just threw a whole bunch of people one by one in these train seats as elements to shoot elements. And I remember just thinking, God, I hope I could get up there. Like I forget who I dropped hints to, like the first AD. I dropped hints to the effects producer. Like, boy, it would be really cool if I could get in there. You know, I just wanted to be in the movie somehow, even if it was just a frame. And sure enough, I got up there and I sat in the thing, and you know, they did a slate and they said rolling and you know, the whole deal. And I just felt like, oh wow, I'm in LA and I'm in a movie. And then literally, I think maybe half a frame, if that's possible, in the final shot. And it just really felt, you know, to be honest with you, like the value of the whole experience for me. I had just landed in LA. I grew up in Southern California, but had spent 6 years in New York. Just came back to LA, lucked into this job. And being on a studio movie with a respected director, seeing all these people that are just so good at their jobs, like people who work on studio movies are the best. Like that's just the way it is. They're the best technicians. They're the best craftsmen. And it was just so impressive to see that type of machine working with hundreds of people every day. But the most memorable experience for me personally for the movie was where I forget if I told this story about the desert tortoise, in that podcast. Dan, do you remember anything like that?
I don't remember any mention of a tortoise.
Okay, here it is. I'll try to make it as quick as possible.
Take your time, please.
So we go out to the desert, to shoot for 2 weeks to shoot these train sequences in the desert. And as soon as we get there and we're out in the desert location where there's a train and everything, you know, we have the safety meeting, and then the wildlife protection person consultant, does a speech to the crew that this area is known for the desert tortoise, which is endangered. And if anybody sees the desert tortoise creeping around, you have to speak up and they're going to shut down production until the desert tortoise naturally just goes away. Right? So you can't interfere with it at all. Right. So it's kind of like, after the first week or something, it's almost mythical, the desert tortoise. Nobody has seen it. And of course all the production people who are on a tight schedule are hoping against all hopes that the desert tortoise just stays where the f*** it is. And, there's a train, a locomotive on a track, and my job as the visual effects coordinator was taking camera notes on whatever effects were going on at the time. So second unit was doing a shot, getting set up for a shot. I'm sort of like away from the rest of the crew, and I'm getting like a cool picture of the train because it's just sitting there majestically on the tracks. And then suddenly I look over and see that the desert tortoise is on the train track. And it's kind of in front of the train, walking away from it, but not more than maybe like 20 feet away from the train. And it's just kind of lumbering along. And I thought, oh my God, that's so cool. And I go over with my camera and I take a picture. And then of course we have to shut down the second unit till the tour. I don't even know what happened, but then I go out and with my primitive camera and my primitive, whatever 2000 era printer, and I print out a picture of the tortoise in the, you know, in the very near foreground, almost like, you know, forced perspective kind of thing, and the train coming in behind it. I print it out and we put it on the wall of the trailer and the visual effects trailer. And then later in that day, Joseph Kahn was in the trailer talking with the effects supervisor, and he sees the printout of the photo and he says, what's that? And they explained to him that I'd taken that picture and the tortoise was there, et cetera. And then, like, the next day, he decided to design the opening shot of the movie around my photo that I took with the tortoise in the foreground and the whatever, the cars in the background, sort of in the forced perspective. And that was, again, as a, whatever, 23-year-old, that was a pretty cool thing to happen on your first job in L.A.
That is spectacular.
Yeah.
I was going to bring up the fact that there was a tortoise in the movie and did it sort of had something to do with this, but you actually designed that shot. That's spectacular.
Yeah, I was the inspiration for that shot. And then they ended up having to, you know, fabricate like sort of a taxidermied tortoise and then devise a way of spinning it around on its back, like the force of the cars had blown the tortoise on its back and spun it around.
Now, were they able to actually wrangle one of the wild tortoises, or did they have to bring in a trained tortoise?
They had to bring in a Hollywood tortoise.
Oh, that's so sad. They couldn't use the actual endangered species to raise some awareness.
Yeah, no, they don't. They shy away from that.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, it was the opening shot. That's. So it's not just sort of a crass cars are slow as tortoises thing. There was actually a little bit more to that.
That's right. And then I think a sign spins around and it says cars suck or something. It was supposed to be a goof on Fast and Furious.
Yeah, the street signs spin fast enough that the letters blur together and say cars suck. It's very subtle. It's right. Very subtle work there. Right out of the gate. I mean, you know, if you watch the first 5 minutes of this movie, you absolutely know what you're getting yourself into and you're either on board or not. Actually, well, there's probably a part later in the movie that loses you because, Joe, I think you were kind of on board in the beginning with some of the insanity before you completely gave up.
No,
you gave up from the opening frame of the cars racing?
I wouldn't say I had given up. I think it was really by the time we got to the titles that I might have thought maybe this was just like a little bit much. For me.
You didn't appreciate the 3D.
I appreciate there was a lot of work that went into those titles and wiping them on and off and having them go behind like the propeller blades and stuff. That's a lot of roto that somebody had to do. But yeah. that was a bit of a long title sequence. And then when they get to the like weird Main Street tent bike town, like I don't know what the name.
It's called
was.
A bike rally, Joe.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
And they're doing their thing there. I was just like, wow, it's the chain, you know, the sideburns McAngry, like, wraps around the other guy and throws him through the window and stuff. And I was like, okay, so Henry definitely James. Definitely not going to turn around for me in this.
Yeah, those bad guys. Has to be clear that they're bad guys.
It was pretty clear. Oh, wow, that's a great tortoise photo that you just dispatched. To us.
Yeah, I just dispatched it to you guys.
Oh wow, look at that. There's the train.
There's the train.
What were the shots underneath the tracks? Was that just all CG or did you guys have to shoot any plates of trying to get underneath like trestles of any sort?
Yeah, that was all CG.
Yeah. Because it goes back and forth so quickly, just between above and below, and then the exploding tire.
It's just such a weird. It's a weird shot to design. Like, why would you ever need to do that? Why would the camera need to dip under the ground, under the tracks, for no apparent reason? There's no good reason.
Yeah. Although, you know, the flying up the ramp that wasn't really a ramp on top of the train, yeah. And then spinning around again once he lands up there. That's one of those shots like we talked about. I don't know if you remember seeing Swordfish. When we did Swordfish, it's another one of those ones that was on like every software manufacturer's demo reel for that year because it was just one of those things. It's, look at this wireframe. The whole train is CG and the bike is CG and it's a digital double and it's awesome, right, guys?
It was the pinnacle of whatever year that was.
I mean, at least that looked more like a motorcycle than like the dirt bikes that were rehoused with like the street bike fairings to go over the dirt.
Oh yeah, there's no reason that those street bikes would ever be ridden in the driven in the desert.
No.
The whole conceit of the movie of the whole movie was pretty flawed.
I guess we're 30 something minutes into it now, and I haven't even mentioned I did have one of those motorcycles not too long after this movie, so.
A street bike?
Yeah, I had a street bike for a number of years.
Cool. Wow. I'm impressed.
But no, at about like 0 miles an hour, I slipped in some sand and fell over one time. So yeah, they don't work very well on things other than asphalt.
Dan, I'm so glad you don't ride a motorcycle anymore, though.
I only accidentally front flipped one time and broke my collarbone, but I'm fine now.
Oh, geez, Louise.
Long time ago.
Yeah, if I had to know that you were still doing that, you were still driving around, I'd just be like, well, one of these weeks we're just not going to have a podcast anymore because Dan is gonna just eat it.
Well, I had a nice helmet and I had one of the silly leather suits like these guys to protect me from losing all of my skin if I hit the ground, but it wasn't quite as colorful and flashy as theirs.
The leathers. Did you have the thing where you could stick your cell phone on your helmet?
No.
Like Ice Cube?
No, that...
That always impressed me.
I didn't even realize that was a thing. I think that's like a thing that, like, old folks that have those giant Honda motorcycles that are basically cars with two wheels, I think they use those to listen to the radio and talk to their friends on the CB and, you know, send out their call signs as they're cruising down the road.
Right. To listen to politically charged radio.
What were those? The Honda Goldwings or whatever?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I have a friend who bought one of those just because he thought it would be funny to do wheelies with.
Dangerous.
I saw on the street the other day, parked in, I forget where I was, I saw this weird three-wheeled contraption thing that kind of looked like a bat, like if Batman had a really dumb-looking motorcycle with two wheels on the front and one wheel on the back.
Oh, yeah, like those Can-Am things. Yeah, those are very dangerous because you can't lean when you turn, so they fall over a lot.
That's right. There's some like vintage archival footage of a three-wheeled car just eating shit because when it makes just the slightest turn.
That's why it's slightly safer now to have the two wheels in the front instead of the two wheels in the back, because if they're in the back, it flips over at the slightest turn.
Right. Joe, what is the most dangerous thing that you do?
drive to Burbank.
Yeah. Get on the 101 sometimes. I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah, I lead a pretty sheltered life. So, yeah, not a lot of crazy danger.
All right, that's good.
What are the crazy things you're up to these days? After your exciting, you know, early 2000s experience, like, are you still living on the edge?
Yeah, this movie had to have been like a high that you've been chasing for the past 12 years, right?
Pretty much. I don't know. I haven't. Well, just recently, just a few weeks ago, we shot another thing for NAVDI, actually. We went to Palm Springs, and it was super nostalgic for me to go and do an overnight shoot in Palm Springs because the last time I did that was on Torque, and it felt really cool.
Did you put a NAVDI on a motorcycle?
You actually can't do that. So it would not be smart to do that.
Well, it would be smarter than, you know, I've seen bikers like just duct tape a cell phone to their motorcycle tank, which is not a great idea.
Wow.
I think we were talking about a movie at some point. Should we talk about the movie a little bit more?
About Torque the movie?
Yeah, Torque the movie.
Never heard of it.
Remember Torque?
Do you guys think there's ever going to be a sequel?
You know, no. What is Martin Henderson up to these days? He's Australian, isn't he?
He is Australian.
Yeah, he sells it pretty well.
Pretty handsome guy.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of handsome people in that movie, actually. I didn't really get close to any of them.
Didn't Joseph say that was kind of the point? Is another one of those sort of kind of jokey poking fun at the fact that everyone in these car Fast and Furious movies is too attractive to be one of these people, so he just went way too far with it and cast a bunch of model looking people?
I guess so, but I mean...
I mean, he's still doing the thing that he's claiming to be making fun of.
Right, exactly. It's like an easy joke to make because at the end of it, you get to have beautiful people in your movie. It's like Starship Troopers, basically. It's like, ha ha ha, aren't we doing satire, but also here's some boobs.
Also, the funniest thing, though, is, of course, Jay Hernandez's stunt double, who I think is three times the size of Jay Hernandez. I think you see in the opening credit sequence there the first instance of just the very wide, and they put him in the yellow suit, too, so it sticks out a lot. He looks like a giant M&M.
God, it reminds me of that Power Rangers sketch, that Key and Peele Power Rangers sketch. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
No, I haven't seen that one.
No, I thought you were going to say Joseph Kahn's Power Rangers short film.
Oh, did he? Oh, yeah, he did that, right? It was an unauthorized, unlicensed.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
No, it was the Key and Peele one.
Oh, you got to go back and watch the sketch, but I won't. I mean, it's not really a spoiler if I tell you the whole gag. Basically, like, Jordan Peele plays one of the Power Rangers, and I think he's in like a green suit, but everybody calls him the Black Power Ranger. Like every Power Ranger is like the color of suit that they wear, but everybody accidentally just keeps calling him the Black Power Ranger.
I do remember that.
I don't know. It's a funny gag.
Oh, they're good. I miss them so much.
Yeah. Well, they're coming back with a vengeance.
Yes, with Keanu.
Yeah.
You looking forward to that one?
Oh, so much. I will tell you the probably the most fun, sort of tongue in cheek, intelligent gag in the movie is when the two ladies do their showdown in the alley, and there's like a Mountain Dew, billboard and a Pepsi billboard.
Yeah, I saw
the bike kung fu, which apparently Joe refuses to refer to it as bike fu.
That's right, I remember. God, I remember that. I remember the Jamie Presley's stunt double was a tiny man named Mouse.
Just because it was the closest in size magic, or just because of what they needed that person to do?
Yeah, or maybe it wasn't. No, I think it was Monet Mazur's stunt double. Just somebody of her physique that could do the motorcycle tricks. Yeah.
There are a great many well done stunts in that, but it is also like the never ending corridor of just the thing they're driving down. Like, you see them about to hit a wall, and then you cut, and then they're 100 yards further back, and they just keep playing the same thing over and over again, and they never end. It's like, apparently it's like a half mile long, but it only looks like it's about 50 yards.
Totally. It was under the 6th Street Bridge. It does not obey any laws of geography, much like the hotel in The Shining.
Oh, so on top of the bridge, I have to ask, the showdown between Martin Henderson and Ice Cube, where they're pointing guns at each other.
Yeah.
How long did it take to shoot that? Because there was always a helicopter just over one of their shoulders as the camera was dollying the opposite direction.
Right. Well, that was my first day on set. And
great. Hold for helicopter and dolly action.
It was amazing. I mean, imagine showing up like to your first day on a job, on a shoot, and that's what's happening. Like, literal helicopters shooting Ice Cube pointing a gun at somebody. And I don't remember how long it took. But I will drive over that bridge and wonder, how the hell did they pull that off? It's impressive.
Now, it's kind of sad now that they've decommissioned the bridge.
Right.
Yeah.
I found it so fascinating and hilarious that every single shot, no matter who it's looking at, has a helicopter over the person's shoulder, and it's just going back and forth. And it's at no point, if I recall, do they cut to a camera on the helicopter. So the helicopter is strictly there for just like as an extra, unless that helicopter was used for the one shot flying above the palm trees out in the desert or something, or like they just had a couple extra hours on the helicopter rental or something. I have no idea why it was used that way, but I'm glad it's there.
No, I don't think there's any rhyme or reason other than that's what you would see in a giant hip hop video.
But like, how do you go to a producer and say like, I need a helicopter. Okay. Are you going to put a camera? No, it's just going to be over the shoulder of some characters while they're having a showdown on the bridge.
Well, you know, it was just a whole money fueled extravaganza. And they just wanted to give, that was at the point where they wanted to give Joseph and everything he wanted, I think.
$30-40 million. I would like to see what would happen if somebody accidentally gave him $100 million. I really would, because he has so many tools as a director. Like, I mean, his visual style is just incredibly intricate in some ways that, like, I don't know how he doesn't lose his own direction when he's trying to assemble these shots on set, because he's not typically one who shoots for as much coverage as possible. He has, he has a shot or a sequence designed in his head, and it's pretty clear.
Yeah.
But like, how do you not lose yourself in this? Like, okay, we're gonna show a close up of him undoing his motorcycle glove, and then we're gonna push into an even closer shot, and then he pulls the glove off, and then there's the watch, and then we rack to the reflection of his face in the watch, and then we whip pan up to his face. Like, how do you keep that straight, and how do you like tell a crew that no, this is what we're gonna spend 2 hours on in between, you know, the actual fight scenes?
Well, honestly, I think he designs all those shots with his storyboard artist, who on that movie was a guy named Stephen Platt, and he would sign all of his boards S. Platt or Splat. And he was a really gifted, he's just a really gifted shot designer. That's another thing. One of those epiphanies that I had on the movie is that you learn how much control on a movie of that scale, as an audience member, or somebody who's dabbled in filmmaking, you're like, I know how much it takes to get like a minute of shooting. How do they possibly stay in getting 2 hours of shooting, you know, on this scale with this many pieces of coverage, et cetera.
And this is on film too, by the way, right?
Right. And on film. Yeah. On 35. And the answer is that they put a lot of people on it and, second unit and splinter unit. And, you learn that on a big action movie like that, second unit is directed by, usually by a second unit director is usually has a stunts background. So they were a former stunt coordinator and they're just gifted at knowing exactly how to shoot an action sequence. And anything that doesn't have the principals talking can go into second unit onto second unit's to-do list. And, so really if the storyboard artist has drawn out these pretty well composed shots, then you can hand them over to second unit to get all those little bits and pieces.
Wow. Cause I mean, there's still some shots in this that I look at and I go, I think I know how I would do that, but I really want to know how they did it. Like there's one that I always see when they're going on their way into the, the fight between the palm trees or whatever it was. But the camera is sitting in the middle of the road and, you know, probably 10, 15 motorcycles ride past it. Yeah. And then it's like one person catches the camera with their leg and it like locks on, but it's a match cut. So it matches so well that it doesn't seem like there's a seam there. It just snaps. And then suddenly there's a leg in the foreground and you're moving along with it. It's like, holy crap.
Totally. It's a hookup. I mean, I was there, you know, on that day. That was second unit. Both sides were second unit. And Eric Durst was the visual effects supervisor. He's also DGA, so he could direct his own unit. And really, I don't really remember how they pulled off that shot, but it was just really good in-camera frame matching and, you know, adding a little bump in the middle with a, you know, some motion blur to sort of hide the seam, and it was really cool. I mean, that was the thing that Joseph would design these unorthodox shots and unorthodox moves and everything, and everybody would be like on board because he's Joseph Kahn and he knows how to make cool visual stuff.
Yeah, there's another one where when Henry James rolls up into Shane's little tent or whatever when we first meet her, and the camera is attached to his like leg as he puts his kickstand down and steps off. And it's like, oh, that's a neat little way to do that. That probably
pre GoPro.
Pre GoPro. Yeah. When you're strapping a 35 mil cam and, oh, that's also the scene that has the 3 second cameo of Jesse James as he throws down a motorcycle rim and then walks out.
Wow. You knew that. I didn't know that.
He's the terrible person that makes, fancy choppers.
West Coast choppers or something.
Yes. He made the bikes that had the drugs in them.
Right.
They're very expensive and, pretty looking.
Is it lonely at the convention when you go down, or are there other people there?
Try as I might, I can't forget all of these things about, motorcycles and what have you.
Wow.
It's fun to ride a motorcycle. What do you want me to say? Like, it's a fun experience, dangerous as it might be. But you know,
have you guys been on those hoverboards? Those newfangled hoverboards that nobody's allowed to ride anymore.
The ones that explode?
Yeah.
No.
I haven't either.
No, I saw kids doing it, and I was like, "Well, this is obviously not something I'm qualified for," so I left it alone.
Yeah, it looks dumber than a Segway does, I think.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Substantially less stable, but people were tooling around in it for a good couple months before the banning.
Yeah, before the government decided they were terrible.
Yeah, I just don't know that I would have the balance for that. I can't stand on a skateboard anymore. That's another thing I used to be able to do when I was young. I'll just fall off and break something.
You can't stand on a skateboard?
Well, I suppose I could stand on it. I just can't ride it without, like, I'm not doing tricks anymore. You won't see me kick flipping over your grandma or something.
Yeah, I was never a good skateboard kid either, and I wanted desperately to be, but I just didn't have it in me.
Out here in the desert, we usually just ride for 5 minutes, and then you hit a rock in the road, and then you fall down, and you scrape your elbow.
I wanted to have a cool mountain bike, but I lived in Florida, so there were no mountains per se, and it was all like in the city, so there was just asphalt. So it really would have made more sense to have any other kind of bike than a mountain bike. So then that was that story.
Well, when I grew up in the suburbs, and we didn't have mountains either, but we had a ton of residential housing development going on in the late 80s and early 90s when the Japanese were doing a lot of development. And so it was actually perfect mountain biking because before they would build houses, they would, you know, do the tracts of land with these perfectly sculpted hills for you to jump on. And that was why to have a mountain bike when you were 11 years old. Wow. In my neighborhood.
So I guess you could always just, you could just get a mountain bike with some of those sweet shocks on it. And you could build like a little wooden ramp. We did that because, again, also in the suburbs, we built like little six-inch wooden ramps.
That's what you do. Yeah,
yeah, you jump and then you slide out.
You don't
out
even need to fasten them to anything. You just put some magazines, you put a plank.
Works out real well.
Yeah.
Completely safe. I don't even know how to get on track with this movie.
I have no idea if there is a track.
No.
There's no track.
Adam Scott's great in it.
Yeah, he's so good in it. He steals the show, I think. And my favorite of his scenes is, I think, and maybe it's in the trailer even, but he goes in like the mini market. He goes up to the guy at the cash register.
Seen three bikers and a chick on a couple of crotch rockets in the last hour.
Must be some water up here.
Okay, words strung together into sentences obviously bewilder you. Let me try again. Three dudes, a girl, and a couple of bikes.
Don't know. Seen a lot of truckers.
Really?
One girl. Man, you should have seen the pair.
Shut up.
I don't know. It just gets me.
Yes.
And to me, on set, he was the celebrity. I didn't care about any of the other people. Adam Scott was the celebrity because I'd seen him in 6 Feet Under. It was the only other thing I'd seen him in, but he had recently been, are you guys familiar with the show?
I didn't see 6 Feet Under, and I saw Party Down, but that was way after.
Yeah, that was way after, yeah. But yeah. In 6 Feet Under, he had a 3-episode arc as a love interest, as David's love interest on that show. And I was a big fan, so I got to fan out on Adam Scott a little bit.
you weren't a big Ice Cube fan back then?
He was pretty good. He was a nice guy. We all called him Dennis. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know what his name is. I don't know. We called him Cube.
I'm Cube, but you can call me Dennis. That's what he says to everyone around the craft service table.
Yeah, I think people just called him Cube. All these dorky white people call him Cube.
Dane Cook is also in this movie.
Certainly. He was, yeah, he was there.
He wasn't anyone back then, was he?
He certainly was not. I just remember he was notable. Like, oh, he's the guy who plays the rich yuppie ass in the sports car. And then, a year or two later, his career exploded.
I wonder where he found Dane Cook, because Dane Cook's also in detention. So clearly there's something there. They have a friendship, apparently.
Yeah, they've got to be friends, I'm sure.
I wonder if he's just a big fan of stand-up comedy. Doesn't Dane Cook, own one of the comedy places around there?
I'm sure he owns all of them. Joseph had this guy who was always in his entourage. There were a couple guys in his entourage, but this one guy, I think his name was Todd, and he was a white guy with dreadlocks, and everybody called him White Rasta. But nobody knew what he was there for.
That's what an entourage is for, right?
Yeah. And then he got to second unit direct something one time, but all the ACs just mercilessly goofed on him. Oh, that was another thing that was fun for me, is because I was in visual effects and I had to deal with the camera department a lot, and I had to also deal with stunts department and my own visual effects department. I think I had 3 walkies on me at all time. And so I was listening in on all of the chatter, all of the department chatter, and it was a good way of knowing the different cultures of a film set pretty intimately.
It's like you had your own little police scanner.
Yeah, exactly. Did you guys have those when you were teenagers?
No.
Walkie-talkies? Oh, yeah, I had this cool little yellow one that had a little bendy antenna on the top.
No, a police scanner.
Oh, no, not a police scanner. I had a walkie-talkie.
when I was... Well, certainly, I think that's... A walkie-talkie is like you're issued a state walkie-talkie when you're a kid. But when I'm old enough that when cordless phones were around, they were not yet on a digital frequency. They were not like, they were just analog cordless, like on a unprotected radio frequency. And you could actually drive around your neighborhood with a police scanner from Radio Shack and listen in on people's phone calls.
Wow.
Is this what you would do when you were bored in the suburbs?
Yep. In high school for like sophomore year, we would do that and we would drive over to McDonald's and listen in on the chatter on the drive-thru at McDonald's. And like the cool trick would be like go through the drive-thru at McDonald's and be kind of rude to them, like, or ask for a water at the drive-thru or something. And then listen in on what they talked about you on their walkies, on their headsets. And then you'd go through the drive-thru again and you would go like, just so you know, I heard what you said. And then you'd speed off and it'd be like, oh, what?
Oh dear. I was imagining you would listen on people's phone calls and then like knock on their door pretending to be some sort of like traveling psychic or something and try and guess things about them for some pocket change or something.
Right. Speaking of which, are you watching Better Call Saul? It takes place in your neck of the woods.
It's one state over, but yes, it's very similar. Yeah, it's great.
It's so good. Are you watching this new season?
Yes.
Yeah, it's so good.
I just got caught up last night, actually.
Yeah, me too. Oh, it's a good one. It's about to get good. Are you watching it, Joe?
No.
You work too hard. You don't have time for that stuff.
Let's just say I'm really, really, really behind because I saw the first episode of Breaking Bad. And so...
You should catch up, Joe.
I have some catching up to do. Yeah.
You don't necessarily need to see Breaking Bad to see this one, I guess.
I feel like I should.
You probably should. Mm. Yeah, you should go in order. It establishes the rules of the canon.
I do get a little frustrated from time to time. Like, some of the openings to Better Call Saul are almost intentionally slow-paced just because they have the hour and they can do whatever they want with character development stuff. It's just like, I'm not entirely sure I needed to see Michael McKean practice that piano song three times.
Oh, but it was beautiful, wasn't it?
It was yes, but...
It's a beautiful scene.
I mean, it's probably the point of the scene for me to get frustrated along with him, but...
Totally. I mean, if you really deconstruct it, the point of the scene is that that's his life, and it's like his life is filled with nothing, with no substance, but he's still getting irritated. There's still something in his life that's not right, and he's still like, something eats at him. And then whatever it is, it drives him to go back to work.
Yeah, his character is something else. It's not the kind of thing that I've seen before, and it's fascinating to watch.
Yeah, I think. Are you talking about
Mike McKean?
Both of them are great. I just love Bob Odenkirk's character so much. His whole it's a gift to do what that character does. Not even the acting, but what the character is capable of in terms of manipulating people and. Just that level of manipulation, the whole Slip and Jimmy thing.
Yeah, that was pretty great. Once we got the the final reveal of where Saul Goodman came from, that was last season, right? But it's pretty spectacular.
It is, and it's fun to see how Ermentrout is becoming Ermentrout.
Mm-hmm.
Trust us, Joe. Trust us.
Yes.
Sounds really exciting. I'm glad you guys liked it.
Joe's never going to trust me ever again now that I've made him watch two Joseph Kahn movies.
Well, what was the last movie that you watched before this? It wasn't Detention, was it?
Before this show right here?
Yeah.
What did we do? Congo. We watched Congo.
Yeah. Congo,
it's a very bad movie.
Yeah, it's not good. I don't know if you saw that.
We took probably too much pleasure in tearing it to pieces because it's dreadful, but
we watch good things sometimes and we watch not good things some other times, but Yeah. That's one of those ones where it's like very comedically bad, but I wouldn't recommend going out and recreationally enjoying it.
I certainly won't. Mm-hmm.
They can't all be winners like Torque.
No.
Yeah.
So I guess for people who haven't seen the movie and probably aren't going to see the movie, I guess we could sort of sum up the plot briefly as what Martin Henderson dating a girl, and a bad guy brings a bunch of bikes to hide off at her bike shop, and they're full of drugs, and he discovers it and hides them, and then bad guy wants his drugs back and is going to kill him, so he goes and hides in Thailand for 6 months, and then comes back and tries to win his girlfriend back, and also call the FBI and get the bad guy busted. That's pretty much the extent of the plot, right?
I think so. I don't really pay attention. You could have said literally anything, and I would have believed you.
The bad guy sells drugs, and he's got $1 million worth of drugs hidden in some motorcycle. I mean, it's. I guess they had to go with crystal meth, because what else could you fit $1 million worth of inside the gas tank of a motorcycle?
Sure.
And then it's just antics trying to get it back, and fighting and things, and mullets and tilt shift lenses.
Yep.
Hoobastank, Nickelback. What was the other song in here?
Am I imagining things, or was there System of a Down?
There was Static X. That's what it was.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay. I get them confused.
Yeah, poor Wayne Static died a couple years ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, I think it was actually this last year.
And then there's the Kid Rock.
That's right, the Kid Rock.
Yep.
At this point, I can't even tell what in the music was ironic and what was just...
I don't... Maybe this is our fundamental difference when it comes to the two Joseph Kahn movies that you make me watch, is that I don't see irony in them.
You're not amused at the poking of the fun at things?
No, I don't think he's really successfully poking fun. I think that he's making some comments, but it's more of like a wink and a nod, and not like commentary. Like this isn't really like a parody of Fast and Furious, but it in certain places it feels like it's almost played like that, but just for like 2 seconds, and then it goes back to like being a more than a little honest kind of interpretation of the same sort of genre,
I suppose. I mean, there's only so much you can do with guys on motorcycles and bad guys with drugs and stuff.
Yeah. But I mean, like, it's not like a straight up parody movie.
I guess we were talking about, like, parody's not really the right word for whatever this is. Do you find this to be successful in whatever sort of poking fun that it's having at these other Fast and Furious style movies?
No, I don't, and I'll tell you why. Because I think parody, in order to be successful, has to be made by people who know what funny jokes are.
You don't think Joseph Kahn knows what funny jokes are?
No, I think he's funny in his own right, but I don't think he knows how to be funny. You know what I mean? Like if you read his Twitter and stuff, he's hilarious. But that's just because of his personality. His personality is hilarious, but I don't think he knows like how to write funny jokes.
You think it gets lost in the seriousness of what he's trying to do visually or something?
I don't know what it is. I don't know. I think there's like, God, I can't explain it. I think maybe I'm wrong. Maybe, but I think his comedy is very like, or his what's funny about what he does is very experiential, but I don't think he knows. There's nothing writerly about it. There's nothing literary about it. Maybe that's a snobby thing to say.
No, I don't think so.
What do you think, Dan?
I guess I wouldn't call any of it funny in like actual comedy, but it's amusing the way it's the point that I was making about this not really being parody is that we already talked about how it's doing the same things that it's sort of making fun of, but
sure.
It also does a lot of those things way better than the thing it is sort of poking fun at. Like, I mean, this movie is visually far more stimulating and interesting than Fast and Furious or any of those movies, frankly. But like the jokey, like, okay, I see what you did there and why you're sort of poking fun at that. It's like, it's fun, like a ride is fun. It's not funny, like comedy funny, but I don't know. I mean, maybe I've come to terms with the fact that this movie isn't like supposed to be anything more than just a fun experience, but maybe it can be or should be in somebody else's hands. I'm not sure. I just think the source material, you know, it's guys riding around on motorcycles doing tricks and stuff and bad guys with drugs. Like, I mean, how far can you push that in terms of trying to be a parody unless you're making something like Scary Movie Motorcycle Edition?
Sure. Well, I think that, like, if you, okay, another thing is in the trivia, one of the first items in there on IMDb is that Joseph set out to make what he calls a dumb movie for smart people.
I think I've heard him say that before too.
Right. And he certainly didn't say to the studio, I'm going to make a funny action movie. I think what he said to the studio was, I'm going to make an action movie that is so hyper real and elevated in the action that it creates, so cinematic that audiences are going to be like transported to another dimension. And they were probably on board with that. And then I think that he just has a darker sense of humor than what the studios were expecting. And there's like, it takes a tremendous confidence to do something like shoot a giant novelty size key just because it's going to please you. It's almost like a Kanye level. I think that Joseph is in the same sort of visionary boat as Kanye West, where they're going to do stuff and say stuff and make stuff just because it pleases them. And they don't really care if anybody really likes it.
Hmm. But yeah, I mean, because who is that giant key for? It's not really for the audience, because it being forced perspective, it's not really the kind of thing that you would notice unless you stared at it long enough. And it's really more of a joke for people like us who know what's actually happening.
Right. It's a joke for us, and it's a joke for film nerds, and it's a joke for Joseph. And it's a joke of excess. You know, it's a joke that's like, the punchline of the joke is, I can do this, so I did it.
But there's something else with him that fascinates me, just in terms of the way he blocks and sets things up. It's very sort of, you know, it's not about coverage, and he always talks about how much he loves Spielberg and how, like, complicated blocking, and he clearly goes his own route with complicated blocking, but, like, there's, like, some of the freeway sequence stuff where we're physically flying through, like, CG cars to change lanes to get over to the motorcycle, and it's like, now, did you have to do that? We fly all the way across into, like, an extreme close-up of the grip of the motorcycle throttle, and then he twists it, and then the entire frame rotates 90 degrees, and then he flies up over the bridge, and it's like, that's something else there. That's like, that's not a joke. That's just awesome looking. And it's the combination of these weird things that keeps entertaining me when watching this, but there's almost like no understanding to be had other than just what is hitting your eyeballs.
Yeah. It's like, it's stunt filmmaking, not stunt as in stunt performers, but stunt like as in, can I actually do this? Can I pull this off? Yes, I can.
Is there value in that other than saying, yes, I can?
I don't know. Increasingly less value as the time goes on, because with visual effects, we can do anything. So let's just restrain ourselves a little bit.
Although, I mean, you know, we can do anything. And a lot of times we do things that are horrifying and we squander that potential. But there are still a lot of things in this movie that are just stuff that you don't see anywhere, that you haven't seen anywhere, and it's still fun to watch because somebody did it. But
true,
I don't know. I mean, does that help in really telling a story that people are going to connect with? I'm not so sure, but it's sure fun to watch.
Absolutely not. Yeah, I would say that Joseph probably does not prioritize story at the top of his list.
I agree with Adam. Because I think that might be part of the reason why I don't really super connect with it. I don't think this is parody either. I don't think that, like, there's that one line where he quotes from Fast and Furious, and then she says, oh, well, that's really a ridiculous line, or really stupid line, or something like that. And it's really on the nose that
that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Yeah.
And which is what I was thinking when he was saying the line. I was like, oh, wait, that's part of the joke. But, you know, it's not like they did that through the whole movie. So that most of the time it's supposed to be like a faithful rendition of a absurd, over the top, cops, gangs and right. like, you know, fighting your own little battle for yourself kind of a thing. Yeah. So it's not like comedy at any sense. And so I completely agree with Adam that it mostly seems like stunts. And that might also be part of the reason why audiences aren't necessarily connecting with this or with Detention, or not at least to the same level as some of the other, I guess you could say films. And I think Detention is probably more of trying to be a parody of things, of several different things. But it doesn't manage to like literally like land and connect in the same way, because I don't think it's about the story and I don't think it's about the characters. And I think those are things that at least I'm hoping to see, or at least more like a punchline jokey stuff and not like just like a couple jokes sprinkled throughout like a lot of really energetic and active and inventive filmmaking.
So let's think of other examples of this genre where it's sort of just hyperextending whatever the genre. It's a hyperextended example of whatever genre it's supposed to be operating in. Can you guys think of any?
Well, I would think of XXX State of the Union, which is...
wait, is that the sequel or the first one?
That's the sequel with wasn't that Ice Cube?
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, in the place of Vin Diesel.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah, didn't see it.
Oh, it was. Well, I guess that won't really help me make my point. But it wasn't.
Wait, no. You've seen this movie?
Yeah.
What? Why?
I don't watch... not everything I watch is gold, Dan.
this is something that I would have said, like, yeah, I watched it on TNT when it was on TV one time, and I feel really bad, and I don't admit it to many people, but you actually went out of your way to see this?
Well, all my friends were going. Aww. I had to go.
Okay. Was this in Florida?
Yes, Dan.
Yeah, it makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. It was an art school, Dan. It didn't totally make sense. Let's be honest.
It was an ironic viewing.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, stuff like that where they take sort of the action to extremes and it's not really like necessarily about story. Spoiler alert for the both of you and State of the Union. Not super about the story so much. So yeah, that would be an example. Of course, you know, Fast and Furious, which I only vaguely remember the first one, so I don't really... think that's it.
Yeah, see, that's still an outlier for me because they are so popular and they're going on to number 8, and for as much as they in those movies say, you know, this is about family, this isn't a revenge thing, they have these big fake themes about how they're all one big happy family and they do whatever they can to defend their family and that's where all of this nonsense stems from, but it's just you know, action porn like Torque, but it's not as fun. So I cannot reconcile that these movies are popular and something like Torque is just like shrug.
I would say there's more of like a soap opera element to something like Fast and the Furious, at least from my recollection, where
it's Torque, but like 10 times more serious. So I guess maybe soap opera, but it's not even like you believe that these characters believe that this is a serious thing. And it's not. It's
well, that's not the point of a soap opera, but
well, it's all about, you know, bringing somebody's clone back who was in a coma or something, right?
You get invested in the characters in a soap opera, even if you don't believe them. You get invested, and I think we can all agree that in Torque, you don't give a shit about a single person, no. character in that movie.
Yeah.
What was that?
Sorry, that's the spring on my microphone boom thingy.
Sometimes Dan just likes to adjust the microphone in the middle of the conversation.
It was ominous. It was like we were in a Paul Thomas Anderson movie.
You want me to do it again? No, I apologize. Yeah. I moved a hand because I was thinking, and I can't sit still while I think.
Don't strain yourself. So if you take action comedy as a genre, I would say that Tropic Thunder for me is the pinnacle of the form.
Oh,
I think
yeah.
that
definitely.
Tropic Thunder is a story, is like an amazing story. The writing is brilliant, and as an action movie, it holds up there with, you know, with good like action movies. Got some great sequences.
We should have talked about Tropic Thunder.
I think I was talking about movies with a lower bar.
Totally, but I'm curious,
yes,
like,
I really like Tropic Thunder, and I think that's a great example of a movie that excels in the genre.
What are some other ones?
You know, the only other comparison I was going to sort of make is that Torque probably has maybe like 50% more comedy, but it's the same sort of like low level comedy that you would find in like a James Bond movie, where there's like some poor puns and like grins
totally.
And winks at each other, and then there's just a ton of action.
Totally.
I wonder, right. I wonder like, if he would be bored directing a James Bond film, or if he would be a good fit for that.
Hmm. I think he wouldn't take it seriously. I think he would sort of squander it. Because you needed to use... Even if Bond is maybe supposed to have some tongue-in-cheek stuff in it, you have to be really, really, like, sacred. You know, sacred about the property.
Yeah, there's the mythos and the mystique of the character, I guess, that you have to play seriously.
Right.
Maybe it's just, maybe you guys just need motorcycles, then you'll like the movie more.
We should get motorcycles, Joe. Do you want to go motorcycle shopping this weekend?
I'll check with my insurance, and I'll get back to you.
Oh, that's such a badass answer.
I think you should go for the Silver Triumph that Ice Cube was riding. It's a 3-cylinder, so it's not too crazy.
Okay. Can I find that on Amazon?
Sure. It's a Triumph 955. Okay. I think that's what he was on.
Yeah.
Martin Henderson was on a very pretty Aprilia, which they don't make anymore.
Hmm.
You know, overpriced Italian things.
Mm-hmm.
I miss my Yamaha. We should start a motorcycle gang. What color do you guys want to be?
Hmm.
Teal.
Teal. Teal. I was going to say teal. We're the Teal Tigers.
Oh, I guess that kind of works with the silly 80s colors that we're fans of. Do some teal and like some bright oranges and stuff. Got to have a little pop of color, you know, for the kids.
Sure.
People can see you coming.
We could be the Teal Pops of Color. That's the name of our game.
How about the teal tortoises? Because, you know, tortoises.
Sure.
You got to bring it back. It's the endangered desert tortoise. There probably aren't a lot of Japanese motorcycle gangs roaming around in the desert anymore. So, have we had enough torque?
I think we've
had
enough
torque.
Have you guys ever
seen the Warriors? Or seen Warriors, rather?
I haven't, other than hearing that it is a historically significant thing.
It's essential. Walter Hill, 1982, I want to say.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it either.
Damn.
I'm sorry.
Shame on you, Dan.
I've seen Dirk like 5, 6, 8 times something, though.
Okay, that does not excuse you.
I like how we both didn't see it, but it's just only Dan's fault.
Well, you know, Joe, I'm coming to expect this behavior from you, but
okay.
Dan.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to let you down, Father.
Oh. Let's ride.